Hello! Welcome to the second episode of Atomic Interviews. My name is Luke Tower, and I am a high school student with a passion for engineering and physics. If you're new here, let me introduce you to the podcast. As I've started thinking about my education and career, I've wished I could talk to more professionals that are already using their knowledge of physics, math, and engineering to understand the world and to make it a better place. That is why I decided to start this podcast, to help me gain an understanding of my career options by talking to as many different experienced pros as I can, and sharing those conversations with anyone else that might have similar questions and passions to my own. I'm excited to introduce my guest, Dr. Leslie DeWan. Leslie graduated from MIT with a PhD in nuclear engineering. She was the co-founder of Transatomic Power, a company that worked in designing molten salt reactors, which would have many benefits over current nuclear reactors. She has received numerous awards, including Forbes 30 Under 30 Award, Time Magazine's 35 Innovators Under 35, as well as serving on the board of MIT. Currently, she works at Criticality Capital, a venture capital fund that invests in carbon-free energy sources and sustainable building and infrastructure. On a more personal note, Leslie's undergraduate project at MIT, a cyclotron or small particle accelerator, had an impact on my growing fascination with both physics and engineering. I found both my guest and our conversation particularly fascinating, so I'm very excited to share it. Enjoy! You might not know this, but you played a role in my passion for physics and engineering. A few years ago, my dad and I were looking for projects we could work on at home to foster my passion for particle physics, and we came across your undergrad cyclotron project. After talking with some experts, we came to the conclusion that it would be a little too difficult. I was already swept up in the excitement of the particle physics, and I wanted to start by thanking you about, helping me start that passion for that project. Could you explain a little bit more about what a cyclotron is and the challenges you would face when building one?
Absolutely. And thank you so much for finding that project and checking it out. I worked on that so long ago, and it always cracks me up, like what a long tail it has on it. So I did the cyclotron as my undergrad thesis in nuclear engineering. And a cyclotron is a type of particle accelerator, one of the earliest types of particle accelerators, invented in the 1930s, used for a lot of earlier nuclear physics experiments, and types of them are still used today for fundamental particle physics experiments. And building one, it was one of the first times that I was building something very hands-on in nuclear engineering. So I was, in the machine shop, and, I had previously learned how to use a milling machine and a lathe and other shop tools. And this is one of the first times that I was using all of that and making something, at a somewhat larger scale. And so it was really fun for me kind of combining the fundamental physics of designing the particle accelerator and also just the very hands-on, like, all right, this is the type of aluminum that we need to buy. This is how we're going to, connect this particular plate to the milling machine. This is how we're going to use the lathe to put the whole pattern in there. So it was really nice and just really satisfying putting together something like that.
It was nice to cross the physical aspects of it with the pure math and theoretical aspects of it.
Exactly. Yeah. Cause it really drove home how some of the theoretical aspects of the design, how they can matter when you're turning it into like something physical.
Were there any challenges that stood out that you can remember from that project?
Definitely. I'd say, one of the biggest pieces was how I had to iterate on the design a number of times because I'd come up with something that would work very well and be very elegant in theory. And then I'd realize that it was just physically impossible to build with the tools that I had. So there were a number of iterations on that front.
Okay, this question is jumping around a little bit to your education, but you attended Windsor School, a girls-only prep school in Boston. I currently attend a public high school, and there are many types of different schooling options available. And you've probably met a lot of people with a lot of different experiences with schooling. So how do you think your experiences differed, and do you think it was good or bad?
I was incredibly lucky to be able to go to Windsor. You know, mostly I had two amazing physics teachers when I was in high school there. Both women, both went to MIT. One was actually one of the first women to get a nuclear physics PhD from MIT. And then in the latter part of her career, she decided to, you know, just teach at this girls' high school in Boston. I think it actually played a large role in my becoming a scientist and engineer, like not just because of these two specific mentors, but it made me very unafraid to ask questions. I think actually it made me unafraid to ask like dumb questions or off the wall questions. I think if I were in a different environment, I'd be too concerned with trying to, you know, I don't know, like to come across as smart or something like that. But in that type of environment, I just felt very, very free to be myself. And I had a wonderful group of peers there as well.
Certainly a different dynamic. So your high school was less than 2 miles away from MIT. Was that always your first choice for college?
It was. I applied to MIT early. Only place I applied to, and I was so thrilled when I got in. I mean, it was ages ago, but I remember very, very, very clearly when I found out. It was life-changing.
You also did your graduate studies at MIT. For that, did you apply anywhere else?
Actually, no, I only applied to MIT for that. It was funny. I actually applied very, very late in the cycle for grad school. I had been working as a roboticist at a company in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and then pretty much a month or so after most grad school acceptances had gone out, I randomly ran into my undergrad thesis advisor, whom I built the cyclotron for. I ran into him on the subway, and I was chatting with him, and he was really surprised that I, you know, wasn't going to grad school and that I was just building robots or something. He said, "You should apply to grad school." And I was like, "Oh yeah, for next year or something." He's like, no, just apply now. Like take the GREs. The GREs are like the SAT equivalent for grad school. Just, you know, take those really quickly. Like I think you can probably take them in a few days and then put together your application and we'll see how that goes. And so I took the GREs, you know, 4 days from then and turned in my application 5 days from then. And I think about 2 weeks later, I found out that I was accepted. So that was, it was a very fortuitous meeting on the subway there.
So you weren't planning on doing a grad degree and it just kind of happened?
I had been, like, it was always something I had been thinking about, but my plan was to stay in industry for a little while longer. Like I absolutely adored my job building robots. We were working on something called the Bear Robot, the Battlefield Extraction Assist Robot. It was this 6-foot-tall humanoid robot that was designed to go into the battlefield and rescue injured soldiers without risking the life of a medic. And so it was so much fun. And I was in the machine shop all the time and working with hydraulic fluid, and I learned an absolute ton. And so I'd been thinking of staying there for a little while longer. But when I had the opportunity to go back to grad school, I took it. I adore MIT. So I was glad to be able to keep that connection up.
So did you always know that you wanted to study mechanical and nuclear engineer, or did you change majors or have any other ideas?
I changed majors, actually. So I started out as a physics major, in large part because of the amazing physics teachers I had in high school. And I did, you know, the first several semesters of the physics major track, and then I realized what I really, really liked was, you know, building things and making things that people could use, like kind of going beyond the pure theoretical. So I ended up switching over to nuclear engineering because that's much more hands-on. And then I added mechanical engineering because I had taken a few machine shop classes before, and I realized how much I loved building things and also how useful it is when you're designing products to have that firsthand machining and manufacturing experience. It really informs your design if you have a sense of like how physically you're going to be building them.
Yeah, I can see why you liked your robotics job with that set of interests.
A great job. And such great coworkers too. It was tremendous. I still miss the place a lot.
So cycling back or going back to MIT a little bit, MIT is known to be pretty prestigious and difficult. Was it also fun?
It was in a lot of ways. I had a really, really wonderful group of classmates and group of dorm mates, especially, you know, there were a lot of fun, like sort of, you know, roof and tunnel hacking related things that we did. That was great. And I don't know, it was, when I arrived at MIT, it was really this sense of homecoming almost, just like, oh, finally, you know, I have found my people. And so that that really made it fun, despite the fact that it was a lot of work.
Could you explain to me what roof and tunnel hacking means? Not quite familiar with that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So it basically just means, climbing around, you know, somewhat unauthorized parts of the building. So like in the dead of night, climbing onto the roof or climbing through, you know, some of the steam tunnels and ventilation tunnels within the building and doing very, very minor lock picking to enable all of that. It was really fun.
That kind of, I guess, connects to my next question. MIT is also known for its elaborate pranks. That's one of the things that when I visited first stood out to me. During your time, did you ever see or participate in any of those pranks?
I only participated in like in the most absolute minor ways. So my roommate across the hall was very, very involved in that. And so she would bring me in occasionally just like if they needed someone to like stand watch and like, you know, radio the people who were actually doing the hack if the campus police were showing up. But I personally didn't, you know, design any of them or install any of them. But there were some really, really brilliant ones, like taking, you know, a whole dorm room's worth of furniture and installing it upside down on an archway that was several stories up and, you know, making a little model subway car that would travel around the Great Dome. There were some really beautiful ones that people made.
The one that stood out to me was I don't know how long ago it was, but it was reassembling a car on the roof of one of the buildings.
Yes. Yeah, that one was before my time. But they took that same car and they have that, I think, on display in one of the buildings. So I've seen that car, but not when it was on the dome. That was a great one.
So MIT is famous for like the saying, it's like learning is like drinking from a fire hose because of the intense pace of learning. Did that apply to you?
Yeah. So it was very tough. Like especially when I was in undergrad and I was double majoring and I was working on a lot of side projects, like it was just like a lot of, and I was on the crew team for part of it too. So it was just like a lot of like not sleeping and studying all the time. I think I realized actually when I was looking through the questions that you sent me that MIT definitely all throughout undergrad and all throughout grad school, it made me cry once a semester, like not more than that, but not less than that. So it got tough at times.
High school can be the same experience.
Yeah. I feel actually like my high school prepared me well for that because my high school was also difficult in a lot of ways. So I got to MIT and was like, oh, great. School is just a grueling slog the same way it's always been. It's fine.
So this is kind of a separate topic, but science and engineering in general, at least right now, is more male dominated. What has your experience been with that?
Yeah, that's definitely the case in nuclear engineering. Certainly, when I was in undergrad, it was a bit more gender balanced. But when I was in grad school, I was often the only female student in my classes. At the time when I was in grad school, which was, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I think there were only two female professors in the entire department as well. That's changed, but it was and is very, very male dominated. And it was a shock to me in a lot of ways because, you know, I had gone to an all girls high school. And so that transition was just weird. And there certainly were, you know, some of my fellow classmates and professors even just like making some really like sexist and inappropriate remarks that were obnoxious, but I found them comparatively easy to brush off. I'm not totally sure why. I think maybe it has to do with my having gone to an all-girls school and this is a bit of a tangent, but I had like never seen that type of sexism before in my life, having, you know, gone to my like Boston girls school. And then when I saw it in person, it wasn't so much offensive, but it was just like, oh, it's this thing that I heard about. It's happening. So I kind of felt like I was, you know, an anthropologist, like witnessing something that I had only heard described before. And so that made it fine for me.
Yeah, I can see how it'd be quite a transition from all girls until mostly guys.
Yeah, definitely.
So after college, you created the company that's called Transatomic Power, combining your knowledge of science and your passion for being an entrepreneur. These aren't often something traits that a person has. How did you find your way in bringing those two very different things together?
I think a lot of it is because MIT itself is such an entrepreneurial environment. Like there were so many of my classmates who had been doing like software startups or mechanical engineering or material science startups, that the idea of doing a nuclear startup, you know, even though it's a little bit out there, it didn't seem too completely crazy. And also there was a good framework in place for, you know, just figuring out how to start companies. Like there was, you know, a group called the Venture Mentoring Service where you could come to them and say, well, I have an idea for a company, but I don't quite know what to do with it. Like, can you give me some guidance? And so groups like that were very, very helpful for me and my co-founder when we started Transatomic.
Do you think the fact that you graduated from a prestigious school like MIT helped you secure funding for the creation of that company?
I think it did, like both directly and indirectly. I'd say one of the most important factors is that it meant that I had a very good network of people to reach out to as mentors and advisors as well. And a lot of our early investors actually, you know, are very, very early investors when we were just starting the company. I think even before we named it, like they were MIT nuclear engineering alums who also had some type of business experience as well.
So it both gave you the degree that looked good and the connections to startup investors.
Yeah, and the technical basis as well.
Yeah. So at Transatomic Power, you focused on a molten salt reactor, which would have allowed nuclear waste to be used as a power source. What caught your attention about the potential for molten salt reactors?
So we initially thought that we'd be able to use nuclear waste directly as fuel, though later on, as we dug deeper into the design, we realized that unfortunately that wasn't the case. But I still see a lot of promise in molten salt reactor technology. You know, one of the things that's so appealing to me about them is the great safety case that they have. So they, you know, effectively can't melt down. So if you have any type of accident, if you lose external power, the reactors are able to shut themselves down and coast down to a stop. Basically, their liquid fuel freezes solid. And also they're at atmospheric pressure. So that means you don't have that large driving force that could potentially push radioactive material out beyond the site boundary. So those were the technical pieces that made it very appealing to me. But also what I thought was super interesting is how these reactors were first identified in the very, very early days of the nuclear industry back in the 1950s. And it was an exceptionally promising technology, but it had been abandoned for decades and decades, because, you know, back in the 1950s, it was much more expensive than other types of reactor designs, and no one really cared about the safety case because it was before there had been any significant nuclear accidents. So like in 1957, you're not going to say, you know, it was before Chernobyl, it was before Three Mile Island, it was before Fukushima. They're, you know, not going to pay two or three times as much for a safer reactor when they felt like they didn't need it. And for me, there was just something nice about revisiting something that had been abandoned from the early days of the industry and trying to improve it and trying to make it better, bringing in advanced materials, bringing in modern computer simulations. I found that quite appealing as well.
Is that why you chose to design a molten salt reactor then? The more common, is it a light water reactor?
Yeah, light water. The majority of commercial reactors today are light water reactors. The main reason we focused on molten salt reactors is because we were able to come up with some new configurations, new ways of running it, some new materials that would not let it run on nuclear waste, unfortunately, but would allow it to have a much higher burn up, cheaper operation, less waste produced than a light water reactor. Light water reactors are great in a lot of ways, but they do have some design flaws, and the industry as a whole is moving away from those light water reactor designs to, you know, what's broadly categorized as advanced reactors. And advanced reactors encompass molten salt reactors, high temperature gas reactors, liquid metal cooled gas reactors, like a whole suite of technologies that can address some of the outstanding issues with light water reactors.
So I understand that molten salt reactors can't melt down and light water can. Could you give me a little description of why? A simple one.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So light water reactors, they have rods of solid uranium oxide as fuel that's cooled with liquid water. And one of the tricky things with these designs is that you need to continuously pump liquid water over the uranium oxide fuel rods to basically carry their heat away. So when those reactors are operating normally, you're pumping the water over the hot uranium oxide rods. That boils the water into steam, and then the steam turns a turbine that drives a generator that produces the electricity. So those light water reactors are basically a fancy way of boiling water. The problem with this type of design is that if you have a leak in your coolant water, or like if a pipe breaks, or alternatively, if you lose external electric power, so your pump is no longer working, then your core is no longer covered. So your uranium oxide rods don't have any water on them. So there's nothing to carry away the heat. And so they just keep heating up and heating up and heating up until they melt. All of the major nuclear accidents were caused by that type of situation. So like at Fukushima, the earthquake and tsunami knocked out the electric grid, the backup batteries and backup diesel generators were flooded, so the pumps went off, and then all of the water boiled away until the core started to melt. And similarly at the other two accidents. The nice thing about molten salt reactors is that they use liquid fuel rather than solid fuel. So you have your fuel. It's a little bit tricky to explain this without a diagram, but yeah. So you have your liquid fuel flowing in a loop within the reactor. Let's imagine on one side, you have your reactor vessel, which is basically a widening of the pipe that the liquid fuel is flowing in. When it's in that widened part of the pipe, it's in a critical configuration. So it's producing a large, stable amount of heat. And then that heat is used to boil water in a separate loop in a molten salt reactor. So at the bottom of your loop that's filled with molten salt, you have a plug that's called a freeze valve. So this is a chunk of the same type of salt that's flowing through the loop, only it's electrically cooled so that it's frozen solid. If you lose your electricity, you lose your cooling to that plug, and all of the salt that's in the primary loop drains out into this low, flat auxiliary container at the bottom, just drains by gravity. And in that container, just by virtue of its geometry and the fact that it's no longer in a critical configuration, it freezes solid over the course of a few hours. And so basically, if it fails in a solid mode rather than in a liquid or gaseous mode. And this is something that they proved out back in some experiments at the Oak Ridge National Lab in the 1950s. So they show this tremendous safety case. They would trigger the freeze valve. They would show how the salt would flow out. It would freeze solid. And then they'd restart the experiment by, melting it back up and pumping it back into the loop again.
So
but
also
it was too expensive back then.
Yeah, I see. And because there's that atmospheric pressure, there's less risk of it being, spread out. Outside of the reactor?
Exactly. Yeah. Because, basically if a pipe breaks, it just stays there. There's nothing that's going to push it out beyond the site boundary.
And this one is a little awkward, but it's important for people like me who haven't started our careers yet. But a couple of years ago, Transatomic Power shut down. Can you tell me a little bit about how that came about and the process of mourning that loss and also learning from it?
Absolutely. And I like that you use the phrase mourning that loss, because it really was it was hard making the decision to shut down the company. And I feel like to some degree I'm still mourning it. But we had to do some significant technology redesigns. We initially thought the reactor would be able to directly consume spent nuclear fuel, and then we realized it wouldn't. We redesigned it into something that was, you know, good, still better than conventional nuclear reactors, but it didn't have that same business case as it did before. And also, we had lost so much time in that redesign process, you know, and realizing that we were wrong before. So I felt like the business case wasn't there anymore. We weren't going to be first to market or second to market or third to market. And I couldn't justify it to my investors anymore. And so I called them all up, and this was a really, really tough series of phone calls to make. And I said, look, I think it's over. And what I want to do, instead of, you know, selling it off to the highest bidder and, you know, chopping it up for parts, I want to put this out into the public domain as much as I can. So we released all of our patents out into the public domain. We went through a review process with the Department of Energy and the National Nuclear Security Administration, and they cleared us to put some of our design files out into the public domain. And what's nice is that it's actually still being used. So there are different groups within the Department of Energy, ARPA-E specifically, and Office of Nuclear Energy, that are looking at parts of our design and using it for some new tests that they're running. So figuring out, you know, different safety and security aspects of nuclear reactors, figuring out, you know, using it to design better pumps and valves and heat exchangers, like using that as a base design. So it's gone on to do some good, which helps a little bit, but gosh, I miss it. Oh, we had such a good team too. I adored the team that I hired for it. And the one last piece, we had, you know, I knew that the end was coming. We all knew that the end was coming for a number of months. So like I had enough time to make sure that all of my employees found a safe landing place, like either at other good nuclear companies, other good companies, or, you know, in grad school, things like that. So, you know, one went on to, he's now getting his PhD from MIT's nuclear engineering program. One just was graduating from Harvard Business School. Like they all found good places. So I was glad that, you know, my people were okay.
That's good. So I'm going to... There's a common held conception that nuclear energy is dirty and very dangerous, but it seems very vital in the fact of covering our bases for carbon-free energy, at least until that technology can evolve further. What is your current vision of the generation of clean electrical energy and nuclear's part in that?
I agree that nuclear is completely vital for building a carbon-free electric grid of the future. And what I imagine, what I would really like to see is an electric grid where you have nuclear working side by side with other carbon-free sources like solar and wind and hydro and geothermal, because I see them as complementing each other very well. I think, you know, solar and wind work very well as cheap intermittent sources. And what nuclear can provide is what's called baseload electricity. So it's just an always on constant amount of electricity. I think also, you know, what's interesting when you're thinking about new power plant design, especially new nuclear power plant design, is that you aren't thinking about what the grid looks like nowadays. You're thinking about what the grid will look like 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now. And I think it's likely that the grid of the future will be much more distributed. You'll have, you know, much more like solar panels on roofs and, you know, small wind farms, for example. And I think similarly, we're going to see more small nuclear reactors, a lot of small modular reactors that could be used to power data centers or chemical processing facilities, things like that. So it's very exciting for me to think about what that grid will look like in the coming decades.
Yeah. Could you tell me a little bit about, you recently founded another company, Critically Capital? Is that it?
Yep, Criticality Capital.
Sorry.
Could you tell me? Oh, no, all good.
Could you tell me a little bit about it?
Absolutely. So Criticality Capital is a venture capital fund where we're that we're still in the process of putting together, that is focusing on investing in carbon-free energy sources, including nuclear power and some types of advanced materials and sustainable building and infrastructure as well. And the other fun thing that we're going to be doing with it, so it's not just going to be investing in existing companies, but we're going to be doing what's called some company creation as well. Because what's so interesting to me about nuclear and, you know, a lot of these other like deep tech type spaces is that, you know, I'll take nuclear for an example. Like there are a lot of interesting advanced reactor design companies that exist nowadays, but there are also like a lot of companies that should exist but don't yet. And so what we're going to do with this fund is like, you know, if there doesn't exist a good company in the space already, we're going to create it. So it would be like looking at some of the instrumentation that these advanced reactors will need, you know, some of the equipment that you need to properly manage the nuclear materials, things that are necessary from a security and safeguards perspective, things like that. So it's like I'm doing partly finance stuff, but then also I get to build stuff as well.
Is there any of the design companies that you're particularly excited about what they're doing right now?
Definitely. There's some really good molten salt reactor companies out there, none of which are focusing on consuming nuclear waste because that's really tricky, but some that have just really, really elegant methods of manufacturing their components, really clever and beautiful designs I'm excited to see how they progress in the coming years.
So this is going back to MIT a bit. So you were awarded with both the Department of Energy Computational Science Graduate Fellowship and an MIT Presidential Fellowship. What was the process of getting those awards and what benefits and costs do you think they had?
Oh, yeah. So with the Presidential Fellowship, that one covered my first year of grad school. And that, I didn't formally apply for that one. I think just like when I think for the MIT Presidential Fellowship, they just, you know, look at all of the first year grad students and just like pick a few of them to give this fellowship to. They say, oh, you seem nice. We'll pay for your first year of grad school. So that one was very, very easy. The Department of Energy Computational Science Graduate Fellowship was much more involved, and it's a great program. Any of the listeners are in grad school and anything at all related to computational science and energy, you should definitely check that one out. They're an amazing group. So that covered my last, 3.5 years of grad school. And that was a pretty involved application process where I talked about, you know, the research I was doing and where I wanted to go with it in the future, how it tied into high performance computing. You know, with that fellowship, like all of the fellows, you know, there were a few dozen of us, you know, we'd meet up in DC once a year and like exchange notes on our work and meet up with lots of people at the different national labs who were doing all sorts of interesting like computer science work that was related to energy. And what I found especially nice about that fellowship is that it was very, very multidisciplinary. So it wasn't just nuclear engineers. The other people in my cohort were, working on life science projects or, new types of solar cells, new types of turbine design. You know, some were just, you know, really, really focused, like pure theoretical computer scientists. And so I was able to learn a lot from a lot of different areas. And I feel like I've still really benefited from that multidisciplinary approach.
Sounds like a very interesting place to have some conversation.
Yeah, it was great.
So you've also been given some awards, I think, by the Times Magazine, Forbes Magazine. How did those affect you?
That's a good question. Because actually, in many ways, it was very positive. Like I was, you know, of course, like very flattered and very honored to receive those. The tricky thing is that like they brought a lot of attention to my company Transatomic in its very, very early days. Whereas, you know, looking back on it, I think it would have been better if Transatomic had sort of, you know, been under the radar for longer. We would have realized the mistakes in our design without having like a super, you know, public light being shown on it. And so I think, you know, I think if we hadn't had that publicity, we could have, you know, realized our mistakes early on, fixed our design, and then, you know, later been much more public about our tech once we, you know, had kicked the tires far more. So I do have mixed feelings about some of those awards, as nice and as flattering as they were.
So it made the mistake a little more public and you grew faster than maybe it was good for you.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, you're always told like, well, if you're an entrepreneur, like, oh, well, if you're given publicity, like take it because you will, you know, you will want it. It will be useful. And so I was, you know, I didn't like decline any of these. I was just like, oh, sure, this sounds great. But in retrospect, I could have been a bit more savvy about it.
So you were also on the board of MIT for a few years, which seems like a real honor for such a cool school. What was the experience like for that? And what did being on the board entail?
Oh, it was a really tremendous experience. One of the very nice things about the board of MIT is that it's quite hands-on. So every board member of MIT, they're actually 70, approximately 70 board members at any given time. All the board members are assigned to what's called visiting committees. And so these are basically oversight committees for different departments. And so I was on the oversight committee for the physics department, for example. And so you and your fellow oversight committee members, you have, you know, very in-depth meetings with the professors in the department, the research staff in the department, and you're able to have just a lot of hands-on conversations with figuring out what the future direction of that department is. And then I also headed up the visiting committee for MIT libraries, which was tremendous because libraries at MIT are they're like an inherently multidisciplinary area. And, you know, there's an amazing head of libraries at MIT as well, who's focusing on, you know, making a lot of changes and like viewing it from like sort of an innovative library science perspective. So for example, like focusing on like, here are new ways to catalog the GIS data from our library of drones that we lend out to, you know, the archaeologists at MIT or the geoscientists at MIT. Like here are different ways we're cataloging our books to make it much more serendipitous to find information when you're doing online searches. So it's just like a bunch of things that I had never, ever thought of before. And then I also was on the committee that overlooked MIT's international partnerships, which was especially interesting because MIT has a lot of partnerships with Russia, China, and Saudi Arabia. And so the sort of political aspect of that was really fascinating to me as well.
Could you give a little more description of the political aspect? Sounds interesting.
I'll be brief on that. It involved there was, you know, much more of a kind of moral element to it than I would have expected. I mean, you know, we had both within that committee and with the board as a whole had a number of discussions, you know, some of which became quite emotional in a lot of ways, talking about, you know, is it ethical for MIT to take money from Saudi Arabia when, you know, Saudi Arabia has, the government has done things that are not great. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, does MIT have an obligation to maintain research ties with individual researchers in Saudi Arabia who they themselves have not done anything wrong? And it's probably better to have open lines of communication. And, you know, similarly with China and Russia, there's the added layer of US government issues with those countries. So there's a sense of like, well, is MIT an American university or is MIT a world university? So sort of it tied into, you know, figuring out what MIT's place is in the world. And those were discussions that I, and I think many of the other committee members, you know, weren't really expecting to have. Like, I was kind of expecting this committee to be like, well, all right, you know, we're working on, like, we're getting funding from X, Y, and Z places, and we have these industrial partnerships. But then, like, realizing the moral implications of where your funding comes from was tricky. And that was before the Epstein thing happened, so.
Didn't get simpler.
It did not.
You mentioned that you overviewed different departments. Was there a particular department that was your, quote, favorite, or that you really enjoyed seeing what they were working on?
I really enjoyed all three of the ones that I was assigned to. Actually, there was a fourth that I was on for the last 2 years. So I was also on what's called the Risk and Audit Committee, so which combined auditing MIT's financials with a campus-wide risk assessment. And so it was basically thinking about what emerging risks are facing MIT. And these range from things like, you know, what if terrorists try to blow up the monkey lab, for example, or, you know, what if there's an active shooter on campus? I was in grad school when the Boston bombing happened back in 2013. And so, you know, there was a police officer was killed on our campus, and that was actually right outside of the window of where my grad school office was. It was frightening. And so the Risk and Audit Committee evaluated all of those potential threats. And I found that fascinating as well. We did not see a global pandemic coming. That one took us by surprise.
Not many people saw that coming. Yeah. Although Bill Gates did, apparently.
Yeah, that's true.
So this is the last question of the interview. This podcast is about me interviewing scientists and engineers who inspire me and can inspire other students like me in my passion for physics and engineering. Who is someone that has inspired you and you think I should interview possibly in the future?
So by far my greatest inspiration and, you know, the reason I, you know, got interested in physics and became a nuclear engineer is my high school science teacher, actually, Denise Lubiniak. She's just like a brilliant scientist and engineer, and also really, really good at explaining things. Like she just cared so much about just like finding alternative ways of explaining physics concepts to her students, emphasizing to us how these could be used in the future in a hands-on way. And and she made me really care not just about the science, but about science communication as well. So I'd love to connect you. She'd be great to be interviewed.
Thank you so much. A great teacher really does make a difference in learning a subject.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me. It was a pleasure to have you.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Luke. This was really fun.
Thanks again to my guest, Dr. Leslie Dewan. If you'd like to hear more interviews like this one, please subscribe. Until next time, thanks for listening.